to Rewind of the Living Dead. I'm Damon Martin.
And I'm Patrick Guerra.
And Patrick, this week, as we are, as always, presented by our friends over at Night Channels, nightchannels.com. Go over there right now for all your horror t-shirt needs and all your other t-shirt needs. You can find them at nightchannels.com. Enter the code REWIND for 13% off your purchase over there. And also check out Night Channels on Instagram. But this week, Patrick, instead of our normal review show, we are actually going to be welcoming in two very, very special guests. A couple months ago, we reviewed a film on Shudder. Hey, Shudder.
And, oh, hi, Shudder.
And we reviewed a film that we both really enjoyed. It ended up on our best of list for 2021. It was a movie called The Boy Behind the Door. And we pretty much gave it a rave review. We loved the film, loved everything about the film. We looked up the filmmakers and we said, oh, they've done other things and they're horror guys. So I looked them up and I just happened to run across one of their Instagrams. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to send a message and see how easy it would be to get these guys on our podcast. Turns out they had actually listened to the episode. We were very excited and honored by that. And today we are going to be welcoming in the guys who are behind The Boy Behind the Door, as well as The Gin, a pair of filmmakers, lifelong friends, which we're going to get into that conversation as well. I am very happy to welcome in today David Charbonnet and Justin Powell. How are you guys?
Doing well. Thank you so much for having us on your podcast. We're really excited.
Yes, thank you very much.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let me start there, because I mentioned lifelong friends, and I've read enough interviews to know you guys have known each other since kindergarten. Now, I'm going to be honest. I don't think I know anyone left from my high school, much less anyone I actually knew in kindergarten. So how did you guys, like, you guys have literally been lifelong friends. Like, this is such a unique story because you're lifelong friends all the time. But generally, it's like, oh, yeah, we met in middle school. We met in high school, met in college. You guys actually knew each other in freaking kindergarten.
Yeah, that's very true. We actually don't know how it happened, the friendship is sort of sustained. But yeah, I guess it's just one of those really rare things. And so far, it's kind of working in our favor because it's hard to make a movie. But when you can make a movie with your best friend, it makes the experience so much better.
Like, were you guys both interested in film in school? Like, because again, you guys are, just for the listeners out there, you guys are originally from Michigan. Now I'm from Ohio. Now, we had a drama club in our school as well, but, like, you know, I mean, we didn't have, you know, a Euphoria level production on our drama club productions, you know what I mean? So we didn't actually have any, like, huge kind of production. So when people think of filmmaking comes from all over. But were you guys always interested in film coming up? Were you guys involved in that, or was that something that came later?
We didn't have a Euphoria level production either for our school, but we've always been interested in storytelling, and we have always loved horror movies. Like, that was kind of one of the foundations of our friendship. And so I think just kind of evolving out of that just kind of blossomed what is this, like, now, like, partnership that we have. So that's to say, yes.
Were you guys making films when you were in, like, middle school and high school together? I mean, that's what I'm curious about, because I've always wanted to make film. I never got a chance to do it until college. So I'm curious, were you guys doing that in your younger years?
Justin probably be upset for me to say this, but we did try a few times, and it was, like, looking back, kind of, like, really sad. But it was really just sort of like, you know, trying to figure out something as we were going along. We really had no education or, like, experience in it other than, like, just loving movies, loving especially horror movies and, like, scary stories. And then I guess trying to figure out, how do they do that? Well, they have to have a camera, and then you have to have someone in front of it. And those, like, early attempts in, like, middle school and high school are just really, like, cringy to think about what we did.
But I think that's great.
Fruition.
No, listen, stuff I did in college supposed to turn in for people did not come to fruition. But I think that's so important. We have a lot of burgeoning filmmakers who listen to us and who message us, and you do have to take your chances. And I think it's awesome that you guys took your chances in a safe place, which was just, you know, hey, we're kids and we're going to try stuff, and it might come out a little cringy, but you learn from that stuff and then you grow. And I have to say, I'm very excited to talk to you guys because we were deeply, deeply impressed. We were saying this before we ever knew we were going to have you on the podcast, deeply impressed with The Boy Behind the Door. I got to watch The Gin two nights ago, deeply impressed with it. You guys are high level filmmakers, like very impressed. So it's, we're happy that you made those cringy films because it created this, these incredible films that people have to check out.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I guess that it's good that we got the cringe out of the way early on. There was more cringe after those years also that we had to get out of the way. So glad that we just got that all out and done with, hopefully there's no more, at least not too much more cringe to come in our careers. Fingers crossed.
Justin, I know from looking, you know, when I was doing my research before we had you guys on, I know you've worked in other aspects of the film industry beyond making your own films. And I know you went to the University of Michigan and worked there. And then of course worked in other parts of the film industry. So have you guys always like wanted to collaborate and do things and it just kind of came later? Like how did it, cause I know you have had other jobs in the film industry. Has it always just been the dream to make your own films?
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like we didn't originally plan on working together. David had moved out to LA, years before I did. And, I was, you know, we were both studying film in our respective schools, but we hadn't like connected the dots at that point that like it would be a good idea for us to work together. So, you know, we would kind of consult each other a little bit about our stories that we were doing on the side. And then, you know, once I finally moved out to LA, we just had this realization of like, well, why don't we just try this together? And then, you know, from there, just, it was like, oh, this is so much easier than I, and not only easier, just everything, was like better. Like our projects were just like much stronger, than when we were apart. And so we were like, yeah, this is the way we've got to do it. And so there was just, that was just that. The rest is history.
David, you took the leap first going out to LA. Now I gotta be honest, like being a Midwest guy myself, like one of the most, I won't say terrifying, it's not terrifying, but one of the like scariest things is leaving, going cross country to a new city and taking a chance on doing something like that. Because again, you know, you have familiar roots, you have familiar things. So what was it like for you, like going out to LA the first time and working, trying to work in film? Because I know it is not, let's be honest, it's not an easy industry to just break into. You don't just walk into someone's office and say, hey, I want to make a movie. Like, it doesn't work that way.
No, definitely not. And gosh, it was really a scary experience, I feel, moving from the Midwest to the West Coast. I still actually don't really know how I did it. I do remember, like, I do remember I drove and I, like, did the drive by myself. And in a lot of ways, that alone, that in itself was really terrifying. I think I was like 18 or just a little over, eight, or no, 18, but like not barely that long. And yeah, it was just a really scary experience. I do know I didn't like know exactly I wanted to do film for the first couple of years. I was sort of really just trying to figure it out. And then it got to a point where I just really had to like ask myself, like, what is something that really makes me happy that I would like to do. And again, that was really scary too, because I'm sure Justin will agree, like both of our parents, I don't think were really excited about hearing that film was something we wanted to pursue. I think like that was just perceived as like a really crazy, unrealistic dream. And I do think they're right. It still feels really unrealistic and crazy even today. But yeah, I don't know. It's sometimes you just have to like take this blind leap of faith. And I feel like moving, just in itself moving, like anyone that's able to like to do that, it really I think shapes a lot of your journey.
You do have to get out there and get embedded and see what it's all about. Like you got to get your feet wet some way, somehow. It doesn't necessarily have to be Los Angeles. It might not have to, it might be New York or Atlanta. But if you want to get into the filmmaking business, I did it myself. I went out to LA. But you guys, you know, your parents were like, that's a crazy dream you're chasing, but it happened. you guys got to make a film. Can you just take us through, because there's no such thing as an overnight success. So we know it took a lot of time. We know it took a lot of hard work. But how did we get to finally the point where it was, yes, we need this filmmaking duo to make this film? What was that moment, that transition to this golden level that everybody looks for?
Oh my gosh. I don't even know if we consider it a golden level yet, but we...
I mean, just the idea of making a film is, to some people, the big dream, whether it's a Hollywood blockbuster or whatever. I mean, you guys made two amazing films, but how did that get started?
It started with several, many scripts before these getting rejected. Finally, you know, I took this leap. I left my job at Lionsgate just to really focus on it full time. David and I had some leads with a couple producers. You know, we didn't have any reps then. And we were like, okay, well, hopefully these producers can kind of get, this was the boy behind the door, in the hands of the right company to finance it. And that still took another couple of years to find that financier from that point. And even when that happened, the boy behind the door was actually supposed to be a go in 2018, and we were going to shoot it in New York. But for a lot of like logistical reasons, budget, and then just some like conflicts with like cast schedules, they had to put a pause on it, and they pushed it kind of indefinitely. And we had told ourselves at that point, like, okay, well, we're making a movie this year, no matter what, like just period. And it felt like Boy Behind the Door was just not going to happen. So we just scrounged together like our savings, hit up some like family, and just like pulled together whatever little resources we could. And like using the, knowing what resources we had, we built a story around it, and that's how The Djinn was born. And so we actually shot The Djinn first. Then once we got to the spring of next year of 2019, we got the go ahead for Boy Behind the Door. So we had to put a pause on The Djinn and did all of Boy, like in like shooting it, finished post. And then we came back to the Djinn, which is why, you know, Boy Behind the Door ended up technically coming out first. Right. So, you know, that's how we got to where we are today. And there were a lot of, I mean, I skipped over a lot of points with some shorts and failures, but those are the big bullet points.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't a straight line. It was a lot of like pivoting, a lot of like sort of readjusting. You get feedback on one story, then you try to do another story that's more in line with that feedback, and then another one. So I just feel like we were constantly just like pivoting and just try to keep going with like the flow.
That takes guts, because you feel like, oh, we've got it. It's happening. And it always, something always gets in the way. Something always changes it. We've said it on the podcast many times. It's near impossible to make a film. The way things continually change, continually get in your way, it's a miracle a film gets made. And you guys got to make two films. So we had a double miracle happen, and that's incredible. But yeah, people got to understand, like, They don't just anoint you. They don't just pluck you out of obscurity and go, you get to make a film. It was years of process. And that's exciting. I'm very excited for you guys that you got to have that opportunity. I'm blown away that you guys made two really solid films in a row. That's incredible.
Thank you so much. And Justin left out one important detail. He knows what I'm going to say, which is, you know, in a lot of ways, The Djinn is really like the most special project to us. And when it did come time for the financier to make a decision to resume The Boy Behind the Door, or to just, we really had to convince him. He was sort of resolved that it just didn't make sense with like these limited hours that we were going to only be able to shoot with the kids, because we sort of got hit with the bombshell that we wouldn't have summer hours, we would have schooling hours. And if we didn't have some of that footage from the gin, Boy Behind the Door never would have happened. Like, just not at all. At least with one. At least with her, with pursued separately.
Yeah.
Let me ask, because again, I want to talk about the Boy Behind the Door in a bit, but I want to ask you about the gin, because I'm a really, really big fan of what I call claustrophobic horror, like self-contained stories in small spaces, like not, you know, like a story that takes place all inside of a house, very much like Boy Behind the Door. But also, like, I was fascinated by the gin that it all took place in an apartment, because that's not a setting you would typically think of, because there's only so many rooms you can run to in an apartment building. And I loved the creativity. And I know I read another interview where it was kind of like, again, that film was born out of necessity. You wanted to make a film. Boy Behind the Door got pushed back, so you made the gin. So that's how it came to fruition. But I love claustrophobic horror stories. And that was, to me, one of the best I've ever seen, because again, I live in an apartment. I know what it's like where you have limited, you know, space to move around. You're not going upstairs, downstairs, you know, left, right, and center to get around a house when you're talking about a very contained story like that. So that was, to me, one of the most impressive parts about that movie. Not only that you did it basically because you wanted to make a movie. It wasn't like something you had predestined to say, we're going to make the gin next, or, you know, that's how it was born. But to take what you had to work with and create a story like that is pretty fascinating to me, because again, I love those kind of stories, but to know that it wasn't a script you had sitting around for like 8 years. Like, it was something you guys worked on and did because you wanted to make a film, and you created it kind of out of thin air in a way, right?
We did. Yeah. That process was, we don't recommend this to anyone, by the way. Like, this is not the way that you should make a movie, unless you're like super desperate like we were. But yeah, how long was the process?
It was we wrote it in 2 weeks.
Ridiculous.
And then like immediately then we shot it like over the next 10 days.
It was insane. Like, it was absolutely insane. I don't know how, I honestly don't know how we ended up with a movie that works, like looking back at it, because we were just like, because we had, the reason that we had to rush everything too is like these resources we had all had like time limits. Like, we were going to lose the apartment. We like, Ezra had like a limit on when he was going to be available and like have to go back to school. Like, just certain like crew and everything, just everything was just like, okay, we have this very finite amount of time to actually shoot a movie. And we don't even have a story yet. So it was this really mad dash, but it taught us a ton also, like that really helped prepare us for Boy Behind the Door. And I think fortunately, just kind of going back to what you said about like claustrophobic horror, like that's something that David and I are also really big fans of. And we knew that with this, you know, location that we had, we really had to embrace it and really just embrace the claustrophobia, and embrace the like the limited, you know, location. And so all of that just kind of helped in the end build a stronger story in a weird way.
What's crazy is that, and because again, I discovered the Boy Behind the Door first and then the gin. And in my, you know, before I found out how it all happened, I was thinking that the Boy Behind the Door, in theory, because you're not dealing with supernatural effects, so you're dealing with just people, you know what I mean? Now, there's some pretty graphic stuff in Boy Behind the Door, stuff we loved, we talked about on the podcast, but the gin actually deals with supernatural elements, so you're dealing with a lot of makeup, a lot of effects, things like that. And to think that that was the first film and doing it kind of like on short notice is kind of wild to me, because I would think that, you know, the practical effects, the real life effects of what you could do in Boy Behind the Door would, I won't say easier, that's the wrong word, but like not as involved. But like, you guys, for having a limited budget and doing this all kind of like, you know, short notice, like, and again, just for anyone that's listening, we're going full spoiler here. So if you haven't seen these movies, go watch them. They're amazing. I know the gin, I believe, is right now on Showtime. Boy Behind the Door, of course, is over on Shudder, and it's also on Blu-ray right now, if I'm not mistaken. So go check out the movies. But just to get into full spoiler territory, the ending of the gin, when you see the gin in like the black form of the djinn at the end of the movie. Like, that was incredibly creepy to me. And of course, we also know the other form with the woman deformed, the mother form, was also very creepy. But to think that you did that, because I would imagine supernatural stuff is a lot harder to do because of the effects, because of the makeup, because of the production that goes into that, than doing something practical. Like, again, that to me is so amazing because, like, the effects looked incredible. Like, I would not have imagined that this was all kind of put together on relatively short notice.
Thank you. Thank you for the praise, saying that. I know we wish we had a little bit more budget and a little bit more time to develop some of those things. So it is really great when it's reassuring when people like respond well to those things. I know we were a little bit worried that maybe some of those things wouldn't resonate the way we wanted to, because I mean, like you said, like a supernatural movie just does demand a higher budget in some of those areas. But yeah, we're really happy, especially I think with the way the djinn turned out, because that was a lot of actually trial and error on set to see what we could do with no money that actually looked good.
Can I ask, because in our podcast world, Patrick, of course, is a filmmaker by trade. He's a director and a filmmaker by trade. And my day job, I'm a writer. It's what I do for a living. I'm a writer. Can I ask the inspiration for the story? Again, I know it was created out of necessity, but like, was there a fascination with that? Like, because that is such a cool creative twist on that mythology. Of course, I think a lot of people remember, I'm sure you guys will laugh when I say this, the old late 80s, early 90s Wishmaster. Everyone remembers the Wishmaster, of course. Where did you come up with the idea for the djinn? Because that to me was like one of the most fascinating. Like, again, the entire story, a mute boy doesn't have a voice. He finds this book and decides that he wants to be, you know, he wants his voice back. And I think any kid dealing with something like that would probably think the same thing and deal with the same thing. But where did that idea in particular spring from?
Yeah, I mean, so most of the time when we come up with stories, we actually come at it kind of from a thematic standpoint. And we knew we wanted to explore like the themes of just grief. And that's like, you know, I know that that's kind of often explored in horror, it seems, but that was something that we were really, you know, interested in doing with the djinn. Boy Behind the Door is different. We wanted to explore friendship and loyalty. But, you know, so we kind of came at it from that perspective and really started building out just Dylan's journey and, you know, figuring out you know, like, well, what would his, like, what would some good wants be for him? And, we had like, because of our limitations, we couldn't make a lot of noise because spoiler alert, like we didn't have permits. And, so we were like, okay, well, what's a good way to like reduce like the amount of noise? And we're like, oh, we could make him mute. So we were like, what, you know, what could, like, what, like, why is he mute? Like, what led to all that? And so we kind of looked at the theme of grief and started building everything out from that with those kind of limitations. And so we grew the story from there and realized like, oh, well, like he probably would want to like make a wish to like undo all of this, like, you know, all this trauma that's led to him being mute and what he, you know, feels like he, like the blame that he puts on himself. And so that out of kind of organically out of that, we were like, okay, well, we kind of have to go the evil genie route. We're going to go, with wishes. And, you know, we did think a little bit about Wishmaster. We wanted to make sure that we went in a very different direction from that. And so we did some, you know, research on, djinn in general. And, you know, we found out some cool things about their mythology and sometimes they could be related more to like the occult. And so we're like, oh, cool. So we could do that with like the Book of Shadows. Another limitation that we had was the makeup. You know, we couldn't afford to have the djinn in his true form the entire time. But like when we looked up, you know, some lore with him, we were like, oh, that's cool. Like he really likes to actually impersonate others. So this is perfect for us. So we can just make it so that like he's taking the form of, you know, people that are deceased, because that's, you know, something that actually they do. So we got to lean into that. And so everything just kind of really grew organically out of just our limitations and the themes that we wanted to explore, including, you know, our titular villain himself. So, yeah.
Creativity born out of necessity, which is another great lesson for burgeoning filmmakers. I had the habit of doing this for the longest time, is like overwriting, making something so complicated there's no way I could shoot it. Famously, I wrote a 3-page script that I think Lime produced out to $50,000. I was like, oh, we're doing too much. But, so I think that's a great message to burgeoning filmmakers, is get creative with your limitations. And I mean, watch The Gin. It's out on Showtime right now. If you got Showtime, check it out. If not, rent it, buy it, stream it, whatever you can do to see what filmmakers can do with their limitations, because it's quite impressive. It's quite impressive what is pulled off, and it's seamless. And you guys, Damon, are we going to start talking about Boy Behind the Door here? Because I mean, it's like you can see the scale up from Gin to Boy Behind the Door, but both are so incredibly refined. Like, I really appreciate how refined you intended to make your films. Like it almost seemed, I feel like you guys were like, it has to look good too. It can't just be, we make this, it has to look good. Big props to your cinematography department. Fantastic cinematography throughout both films. Was that something that was a big deal for both of you? Because both films look incredible. They look properly cinematic.
Definitely. And thank you so much for saying that. Visuals, I mean, it's a visual medium, right? So even though you're working with a small budget or limitations, there's always a way you can, you know, if you really put your mind to it, you can find a way to, you know, tell the story in the best visual sense or capacity. We put a lot of emphasis on that, a lot of emphasis on shot listing, you know, with both stories, but particularly with The Gin. You know, we never wanted it to feel monotonous because it is such a small space. So we really worked long and hard with our DP, Julian, who's so amazing. And we're like, look, how do we make this space visually interesting? We don't want people like get bored. You know, we have to sustain the story. And what are some cool, interesting ways we can, you know, light things or compose shots, maybe, you know, changing POV or, I don't know. It allowed us sort of the freedom to explore what we could do again, like with what we had. And we really like working with Julian. So we had a good experience with both movies.
Yeah. The Boy Behind the Door, again, that was the first film of yours that we saw, and it's really heavy subject matter. I mean, let's be honest. It's really heavy subject matter. We're talking about child abduction and, you know, I mean, it's terrifying. I think I love supernatural horror films. Like, I grew up in the 80s and I love, if you look behind me, you can probably see my Nightmare on Elm Street Dream Warriors poster. Like, I am a full on like slashers 80s, like, you know, Halloween. I love all those movies. But like, when you think about like one of our shared favorite movies, Patrick and I, we always talk about on this show, is Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And like, one of the things that's most terrifying about a movie like that, even though it is exaggerated, of course, is that it could happen. I mean, there's nothing supernatural about a group of psychos living out in the woods somewhere. Those kind of movies are always, to me, a little scarier because they can't happen. We're not injecting, you know, vampires or zombies or, you know, a mythological killer that can't die, those kind of things. Then you inject something like children. And I don't have kids. Patrick does. But even that, like, I understood the heavy subject matter. Like, it's a really heavy story. And that makes it that much more terrifying. Like, watching and kind of living through those kids' eyes in that movie, I was scared for them every corner they turned in that movie. What was the, like, what would, because again, I know that was the first one you were planning on making. So again, talking about the inspiration, like, to go that route, because it's really heavy subject matter dealing with something like a, you know, child abduction, and we're talking about, you know, trafficking and all these different things. I mean, that's a really, really heavy subject to get into.
Yeah. First, I just want to say with Texas Chainsaw, I do feel like there's possibly an argument that there is a little bit of a supernatural thing in there, just with the grandfather.
I was going to ask that if you guys, since you guys are really big fans, because Justin and I have been rewatching the movies recently. It's really funny you mention it. And we were sort of trying to figure out, like, is there something supernatural with the grandfather? Because the director said, I think after the second one, that he drinks blood to sustain himself. So what is going on?
It's a good question. It's a legit question. You say that is a legit question. And the grandpa in the first one is like one of the creepiest parts about that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would just chalk it up to he's Texas built. I mean, they're hard to put down. That's just what it is. And we've had people in our family that lived incredibly long and lived very interesting lives. So I'm going to chalk it up to that. But there is something to that drinking the blood to sustain life. I mean, there's rumors that goes on in Silicon Valley, that people get young blood injected. I mean, that's kind of an older idea. You know, it's out there. It exists.
Well, I know it's like that's getting off subject, but
no, I love that you guys are nerdy enough to want to ask that question.
But yeah, I guess, yeah, with the idea for Boy Behind the Door, it honestly kind of started really, really simply with there was like this whole idea of just exploring the idea of like this kid trapped in a trunk. But from there, we realized like, okay, how do we build, like, we need to really build more of a story out of this. And so we started kind of looking at, once again, themes that we wanted to explore. And, you know, we really thought that like themes of like friendship and loyalty, like, you know, set against like a horror backdrop would be really fascinating. So that's kind of where like the Kevin character came in. Okay, we're like, they have to be two best friends and, you know, building out like the motivation for why he would be going into the house. It's like, okay, he's got to go and save his friend. And so, so everything just kind of grew organically out of that. But once again, it was kind of like this weird seed of like, oh, what if there was, yeah, like this kid was like abducted and trapped in a trunk. Like, what could we do with that? And then like, just looking into the themes of friendship and loyalty. And I do feel like over time, kind of like David and I's own like relationship got kind of woven in a bit with these guys. We've discussed at length who would turn back for the other. And I am definitely, I would have left. So David's more of the Bobby, because he was like, oh, I would have turned back. And I'm like,
then you don't have a movie.
Right.
Justin's like, you're on your own. Sorry, buddy. You're on your own now.
I don't know how to, I wouldn't be able to save you.
I will say with the, you know, the sex trafficking component, we really just wanted that to be a backdrop. We never wanted to like focus on it as like something explicit or like shocking for shocking value. Or shocking like value of it. It was more of just like what logistically makes the most sense that two kids would be taken for. Like they're not going to be like kidnapped for like scientific experiments, right? So we just wanted to be like what seems the most like true, and it actually does happen. But we really wanted the focus of the story to be about these kids and anything scary that's happening, it's more about like them trying to escape and protect each other versus like anything that may happen in the future. Or, you know, even on set, when we talked with the kids, we never ever talked about like, this is what's happening to these boys that are being taken. It's always about like, these are bad guys and you don't want to get caught by the bad guys. Like,
Everything was kind of subversive in the movie. Like nothing was exploitative. You know what I mean? Like that's what I liked about it, because we all know there's films out there where, you know, people are doing it to be exploitative about whatever subject they're talking about. Maybe not even something as serious as sex trafficking, but just subject matter in general. It was so subversive. Like I was watching it and like I had to think about what was happening. Like, I was like, oh, that's what's going on in the background. Like, that's what's going on. Like, it wasn't that you weren't beating us over the head with it saying, look what happened. You know, we're not doing it that way. But I think that's what made it that much more effective, is because, like, we had to kind of figure it out. And when you do figure it out, it's that much more disturbing. Like, it wasn't something you're beating the audience over the head with and saying, look what we're doing right here. You know, big flashing lights of what's happening to these kids. In a lot of ways, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but, like, in a lot of ways, I followed the story through the kids' eyes. Like, I was seeing what they were seeing. I didn't fully understand, but I understood it. But, like, I had to understand it from their perspective.
Yeah, that's what our goal was, really. You know, even with it was kind of cool, like, as we were shooting it, you know, because we have so many, like, long flowing takes, even with the kids, like, you're kind of at this eye level that you're not even used to being at, I feel, where you're a little bit lower. And, like, so you really kind of do get to put yourself into, you know, their mindset. And, like, you know, their focus isn't on, like, well, why are they doing this and all that. It's like, no, I just got to get my friend and get out of here. Like, we're in trouble. Like, let's go. And so that's kind of the experience and the ride that we wanted to take the audience on. And I think, in general, David and I are always of the mindset of, like, less is more when it comes to exposition. And so if there's, as long as there's, like, just something that is really simple that people can just kind of understand and, like, infer without having to go into a whole bunch of backstory, we're always going to kind of go that route. And so I think that's kind of why the child trafficking came out organically, because everyone's going to just kind of get that that's what's going on.
And I will, if I can just add, Damon, it was so important for us to, like, maintain this POV of these kids. Like, we wanted the whole story to be that. And even though the movie's been really well received and we're really thankful, you know, a couple, like, people may have said, like, well, where are the parents? Aren't the parents looking for them? Where are the cops? It's like, yeah, duh, the parents are looking, but, like, we're not following that. And, like, it was really important that we didn't, like, add in other storylines that were, like, cutting away to a different location where you could, like, ease up and, like, the drama. Like, no, we wanted to stay, like, in the immediacy of, you know, what these kids are going through. There's, like, an urgency. And once you cut away to parents, you know, worried on a couch, talking to a cop, like, I don't know, we wanted to follow Bobby and Kevin.
Yeah. And it's like, cause it's a cumulative experience. I mean, like, every movie is, but I feel like, especially ones where you're trying to create a sense of claustrophobia and, like, tension, you know, the moment you cut away to a different location, like, you cut that tension and then you have to build it up again. Like, when you cut back, and it's like, you, instead we're like, no, we're going to just have a steady build the whole time. We don't want to ever let up. We don't want the audience to ever kind of feel that moment of relief of, like, okay, well, like, let's see what's going on with the parents. Like, no, like, you're going to be in it with these kids, terrified with them. So yeah.
What you guys did there, and we talked a little bit about it on the podcast, is you did something that actually many even great and beloved horror films fail at, is you by keeping it with the children, sustain the dread. The sense of dread in a horror film should be building and building and building to a crescendo. Oftentimes, we literally just divert to a party. We divert to people talking and hanging out. We even mentioned on the podcast about The Boy Behind the Door. There is another version of the script where there's a detective banging on the dashboard going, damn it, I can't find these kids. And you're like, okay, come on. Like, we've seen it. And you guys stuck with the dread. And we've been saying that since day one on this podcast, is sustaining dread is the key to a great horror film.
Patrick, thank you for that. Thank you. But
wait a minute. Did somebody in this group say, we need a detective? We need, who did one of you suggest to cut away to a detective?
Not one of us.
There was someone that was pushing us very, 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 very hard to add in, like, mm-hmm. a Donald Pleasance character.
Right.
That would be concurrently searching for the boys, talking to the parents. Mm-hmm. And that was definitely, that was probably our biggest fight and hurdle overall, was to make the case that we would think it'd be a stronger story not doing that.
Yeah, to mix that character.
Yes, we appreciate your fight, because I hope whoever that is gets to hear the podcast. And here's it from the fan perspective that yes, when you cut away to that stuff, we lose interest. We do.
Thank you. I don't think they're going to watch this knowing we're on it, but thank you.
Fair enough. But that's the reality, is that when you're putting these things together and there's other people's money involved and other producers involved, they want to have their say. They want to have their thing. And it's a director's job to get into fights, and not, and I don't mean that in like a macho, like you have to fight for what you believe in. You guys did it, and it succeeded just incredibly.
Definitely. I mean, we definitely believe, obviously, film, it's so important to be collaborative. There's so many different people participating. We love the collaborative experience. You know, that's always what makes a story and a project the strongest. But you also, you know, sometimes have to figure out what's really worth fighting for. And I think that was one of the things that we're really glad we, you know, we're kind of like shy Midwest guys. So it's sometimes hard to, like, you know, really voice certain things like that. But it was worth it, I think, in the end.
We're glad you did it. Yeah. As fans, we're glad you guys fought for it.
Thank you.
Can I ask you real quick about some casting? Because, of course, one of the big twists in The Boy Behind the Door, which it threw me off, of course, was, you know, when you revealed that the kidnapper is a woman, which is not something we saw coming. And Kristen Bauer Van Stratton, I've been a fan of her since, let me go all the way back to when she was on Seinfeld. And then, of course, you know, everyone knows her from True Blood. She's an incredible actress. But we've talked about this on the podcast with other movies we reviewed. And I think Patrick and I both have like a shared terror of ever working with child actors, because some movies are made or broken by child actors. We've talked about it. Like we did a 2-hour podcast talking about our love for The Lost Boys, like how much we loved that movie and how much the child actors in that movie like raised the bar. And then we've done others. I'm not going to name names. I know Patrick knows what I'm talking about. We're like, man, like it was just rough. Cause like they could, whatever was going on there, they did not get good performances out of the kids. And it's terrifying to us, because it's like, that's, again, you're dealing with a child. Like they're not going to have the same emotions and maturity as an adult, whether it's criticism or just trying to get the most out of them. Now, you've worked with Ezra now twice, which I was joking before we had John. I was like, man, these guys like torturing that poor kid. Between the gin and Boy Behind the Door, that kid's seen some stuff. But what was it like working with kids? Because it's scary to me, because like I'm always worried about like how would you deal with that? Because again, it's, you're dealing with a child. I mean, this isn't like these aren't like 19-year-old kids playing 15 or playing 13. These are kids.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, one of our biggest concerns, I remember going into everything, was like, how are we going to find kids to carry, you know, something this heavy and this intense? And fortunately, we just had the absolute like best casting director, Amy Lippens. And she honestly just made that process really easy. She thought of Lonnie like really, really like right away. We knew him from This Is Us. And then, you know, she brought in a bunch of great kids. But Ezra was one of the first ones, and we just kind of knew right then. We're like, oh, well, he's Kevin. Even though we had to go through the rest of them. And, you know, in terms of like working with kids, like once you find the right ones, like the performance part of it actually isn't, very difficult, because the cool thing about like good kid actors is that they're just kind of being like authentically themselves. They aren't really acting, like, so they're just kind of putting themselves in that situation and just like, you know, getting to kind of go along the ride of just being themselves in like a different scenario. The scariest part, which we weren't really ready for, is like they're limited hours. And especially when you're up against like night, because, you know, we had to often be done by like 10 p.m. Yeah. This whole movie's at night. And then you only have 5 working hours with them, like outside of that. So it's like we're shooting with them, it feels like 3 hours total. And they're in every frame of the movie. And so it's just that was the stressful part of it. But I feel like in terms of working with kids, like, it's not scary if you just, if you find the, like, the right ones. So we really loved working with Lonnie and Ezra. They're like really, really talented. Obviously we've worked with Ezra now twice. So we do it again. And interestingly, I feel like at this point we just kind of have more experience working with kids than even adults. So we're in a good flow with that. So
it does come down to a great casting director, as Justin said, and we can't sing enough praises to Amy. You know, if you're lucky enough to get the right team members, just makes life so much easier. So we definitely had a lot of all-stars on our projects.
Now we, go ahead, Patrick. No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, just to reiterate, like, Ezra and Lonnie do exactly what you were talking about, Justin, which is they were being authentically children. You didn't have little adults that came into the casting room and, you know, were trying to talk to you on your level. Like, it just, I'm very impressed with what they did. And yeah, a great casting director can make or break something. That's amazing.
Now we've had a, I think you guys can tell the adoration we feel for both your films, and The Gin, and of course The Boy Behind the Door. But I gotta tell you, listen, I know you came on here to talk to us and have a great conversation about your movies, but I have to throw out a criticism. So I'm sorry, I have to do it here. Now
it's okay.
There's one part in Boy Behind the Door where I felt personally attacked. And I just want to tell you about this because it was a really traumatic moment for me in that movie. And I just want to share that with you so you know. When the kids don't know how to use a freaking telephone, I felt like you were attacking my age because I was like, they don't know how to use a telephone. And Patrick and I joked about this on the podcast. We're like, yeah, I guess kids of that age wouldn't know what a freaking rotary telephone looks like. But I felt personally attacked because I was like, how old do I feel right now that I actually know how to use a rotary telephone?
Thank you for not mentioning the bumper sticker or the blood cleanup. Justin, do you want to talk about the...
I also thank you for not mentioning those two things, but it's really funny because, when we got to that, it's once again, we're just approaching things organically and we were just like, okay, yeah, like kids just realistically wouldn't know that, right? And we like had looked up these videos online of like kids that were significantly older than Lonnie and Ezra trying to work. It wasn't even a rotary dial phone. It was just like a landline. And they just didn't like, they would dial the number and then pick it up and they didn't understand. And then like the rotary was even worse. Like they just had no idea what to do. The fact that Bobby and Kevin are actually even able to figure out how to operate the phone is actually probably less realistic than
and the easy blood cleanup.
The blood cleanup, which we had no time to shoot. The damn blood kept drying every like 2 seconds. Lonnie had like 10 minutes left. People were screaming at us. It was just like a nightmare. I'm surprised we got any footage that day.
That scene was supposed to go down very differently. It's unfortunate. But it's one of those things where you just have to make do. We got what we got, and we're thankful we got something. Yeah,
but we're going to do a blood cleanup scene again.
All jokes aside, like I love the authenticity of that, because when we were talking about, like, we joked about in the podcast, we're like, oh my God, that's true. Kids wouldn't know how to use a freaking phone. Like, it's just like, I was like, my God, I feel old right now.
Especially a rotary.
Yeah, because like, I grew up with landlines. Like, I have, no one has, and we actually talked, we're like, no one has a landline anymore. Like, no one, I wouldn't really, like, that to me was the kind of detail that I loved about your film, because, like, I'll be honest, like, I'm a writer. This is what I do for a living. I would never have thought of that. Like, I would have never thought a kid wouldn't know how to use a rotary phone. Like, it just doesn't, it wouldn't have clicked in my head. And when we said that, we loved that part because it was so specific to show how young these kids were, because we're like, oh yeah, that's true. They would have, this would look like, you know, this would look like a Commodore 64 computer to them. They have no idea what they're looking at.
Yeah. That was a lot of fun. Go ahead.
I wish we had instilled more moments like that, looking back. Cause that moment, just like a breath of like light levity. We love horror that's able to, you know, infuse stuff like that. And I do wish we had the opportunity to have a little bit more of that. Maybe next
time. Conversely, I would say what I got out of your film that I don't get out of a lot of horror films that I truly enjoy is at the end, just being like, I can't breathe. I'm so stressed out. Like, oh my God, like very few horror films that I love, that I genuinely think are amazing, don't do that to me. I turn off the TV and I walk away. I had to like decompress from The Boy Behind the Door. And that's not a bad thing. I'm not saying a bad thing. I'm saying like you made one of those horror films that I had to grab my chest and just be like, okay, we got through it. We did it. So we didn't have those moments this time. That's okay. It made for something that was incredible.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you guys really did, when you talk about like the effects and like some of the graphic stuff in there, I think Patrick and I talked about like our favorite bit of gore, and oh God, there was a couple moments in that movie that like had us cringing really hard in a good way. Like it was just like, you know, I think, you know, the parts we're talking about, but man, you guys really did kill it with those parts, because again, kind of like we talk about anything else, like there's parts that can make or break your film. And when you get a horror fan and like hardcore horror fans like us to like cringe at a part of the movie when you're doing something, that says something. So bravo on the creativity is some of the things you did, man. I mean, you really pulled off some really spectacularly terrifying moments in that movie, especially with the effects, like the toenail, oh my God, the ankle. There's so many points in that movie that like I'm thinking about right now and I'm like ready to shut my laptop. I can't think about.
Thank you. Yeah, those were a lot of fun to the fingernail actually wasn't in there originally. That was something that was added a little later. The thumb though was something we had been looking forward to for a very long time. I remember like writing that and just being like, oh my God, I can't wait to shoot this. and just like, just the whole, that was another thing where, same person that we referenced earlier, the thought was like, that's going too far. Like the finger like left in the wound, like, and taking it out. It's like, no, this is good. Like you got to have like a couple moments that are just really like, and it's like, this is going to work. So really happy that we got to keep that and that it turned out the way it did. That was just, I think, our first time working with, gore effects in that kind of way. And just seeing the dailies and the footage, like as it was happening, like everyone on set was just like cackling with laughter, and just, it was so great. Yeah,
absolutely.
I do think when, you know, when you make a movie, what we've sort of tried to like follow as like a rule, which with like things like gore and stuff, is, you know, if you're worried it might be too much, I think, you know, still plan to shoot it and still shoot it, because you can always like pull it back in the edit. But if you're, you know, when you're there and you have the actors, if you don't do it or try it, you'll never know. You'll never have that footage. You can't really go back for it. It's not like, it's usually really hard to sometimes go back for things like that. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of, I think, how we approached that. Like, maybe it might be too much, but let's still shoot it and we'll see what we have.
That's a great bit of advice.
Thanks.
So before we get you guys out of here, as we said, we want to close out with some questions we like to call our horror questionnaire. And we're going to get a little bit of background on some of your favorite things and also maybe some things about what you got going on in the future. So I'm going to kick things off. And again, feel free to answer however you want, both of you, in order, whatever. But basically, we're going to kick off things, and I'm going to ask you guys about, of course, you guys grew up and you mentioned you're both horror fans. And again, even, you know, novices like us, like guys who love film and want to be filmmakers, we have our favorites. So I'm curious, Who would you guys consider the most influential filmmakers or films from horror that like kind of shaped you guys as filmmakers? Is there one or two in particular, whether it's a film or a filmmaker in particular, that you guys loved?
You want me to go or you want to go, David?
You can go first.
I always feel like I take all of yours when I go.
You do, but I'll fill in the gaps.
That's like us, Damon. I take his categories sometimes, so we get it.
Well, okay. Yeah, we've got a lot. I'm just not going to go through a bajillion like I normally do. I feel we really, really love Stephen King, John Carpenter, more recently, James Wan. I think that Wes Craven, I mean, they're okay, I'm going to do the thing where I go again. But wait, I mean, like, we really kind of like horror that has a lot of nostalgia in it. You know, we grew up late 80s, 90s. So I think that tonally, we kind of draw a lot from that era. I think that, you know, in both of our films, you kind of see nods to films from those times. I remember just feeling like we were like, okay, well, these might be the only movies we ever get to make, so let's like drop in like whatever references we can while we have a chance. Maybe we'll go a little less reference heavy in the future. But it was just like we were really excited to even have the opportunity to kind of honor some of these films that we grew up with, because, you know, like first and foremost, before we're filmmakers, we're just fans of the genre, like, you know, so many others. So so David, I'll give you that leeway to give more detail.
Well, no, you did pretty good. I do one who we really love, actually, that you forgot, is Don Mancini. Child's Play is one of our favorite movies. horror movies, but movies in general. And like, I'm sure you caught like the reference to that movie in our Friends to the End theme.
Mm-hmm.
Justin mentioned the nostalgia, obviously, like Spielberg, everyone says that, but just like the Amblin feel of what it's like being a kid and that sense of wonder in like the 80s is really influential. And then, yeah, obviously, big James Wan fans, Mike Flanagan, really like sort of that newer, modern, like elevated horror that we're seeing from a lot of those types of filmmakers, just sophisticated and really
still fun.
Fun, yeah. But also has like, you know, a good emotional core and like characters that feel substantial.
Yeah, I think that's what's great about modern horror is exactly that. There's an emotional compass to these movies that a lot of the movies we're nostalgic about don't have. And whenever we talk about like a classic horror film on here, we're like, oh, that's a really cringy moment because they were clearly not thinking emotionally. And I think now most of the great horror filmmakers out there, yourselves included, think emotionally about their approach to filmmaking, and it makes for evergreen stuff. So that's cool. And I see all those influences that you guys are mentioning. I can see them in the work. And yeah, tremendous job.
Oh, thank you very much.
So now from there, I'm curious, and I know this is going to be a big one, because as filmmakers, you get these opportunities. So I don't want to ruin anything you might have in the works. But I always love to hear the answer to this question, which is, you guys are filmmakers, and we are in the horror genre, and a lot of horror we know is based around a franchise. So here's a question for you, which is, if you guys had a chance to work on another franchise, whether that means making a sequel, making a prequel, or potentially doing a reboot, because we've seen a lot of the reboot universes in different films and things like that, what would you pick and why? So if you wanted to make a prequel to The Shining, why would you make that? So what if you could pick one horror franchise, one horror film to make a prequel, a sequel, or potentially a reboot, what would it be?
It could be like a remake.
You could do a remake, sure.
Like a franchise, or can it just be a one-off?
It can be a one-off. Whatever you want. Whatever you want. Yeah. An existing IP that you would like to take a stab at.
Cujo. 100% Cujo. Maybe David might have been preparing to say something else, but definitely Cujo is there.
We've talked an insane amount about how much we love Cujo. Just like the essence. Again, I think it's one of those, like when you rewatch it, the memory of the concept, I think, is a little bit stronger than the actual film, because there are a lot of moments that do cut away for some reason, when like what's really terrifying is like the intensity and the urgency that, you know, this mother protecting her son are in. So we really love that. We think that would just have so much potential for like just such a high intensity, nonstop thrill horror ride. There is one we've also talked about, Gremlins. We would love to do a remake/reboot of Gremlins with like sort of ignoring the second movie.
But don't like the second movie?
It's a little goofy. You
know? A lot of goofy.
I mean, I watched a commentary where like I think the director and the filmmakers were just so burnt out by like the first one that they sort of wanted to make a mockery of a lot of those things and like a joke. But the first one just has such a great emotional core to it, and it actually is truly scary. I don't think the second one's scary. I'm sure a lot of Gremlins are gonna hate me, but
it's not a scary. That second one's not even remotely a scary movie.
It's kind of like going from Texas Chainsaw Massacre to Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. I love Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, but it's a completely different kind of movie. Like in terms of like there's so much more humor and purposeful humor put in there, whereas the first one is just truly terrifying. Yeah, you're right about that. I'm fascinated by the Cujo thing, though, because I was scared out of my mind when I saw Cujo. I got bit by a dog when I was like 5 years old, and I was terrified of dogs until I was like 15. Like, I would not go near dogs. I was always scared after I got bit one time by a dog. And Cujo scared the hell out of me for years. And I actually just, I'm not even kidding, I literally just picked this up on Blu-ray like 2 weeks ago, because I had seen it on streaming somewhere, and I watched it, and I was like, oh my god, I remember how much I loved that movie. And I picked up the Blu-ray, and I was like, I loved the concept of it. It was a terrifying movie when I was a kid. I was talking earlier about how you guys like claustrophobic. Are you guys just shrinking your spaces here, like going from like an apartment down to a car? Because Cujo's, I would love to see that. Like, you guys really do have a way with that claustrophobic horror, and boy, can you get more claustrophobic than, you know, a mother and a son being trapped in a car with a rabid Saint Bernard outside trying to eat them.
I do think that our take would open things up a little bit, at some point, but we would really lean in on the kind of nonstop intensity, that, you know, at least where our memories go for the experience. So it would be much more of that throughout the entirety of the experience.
If you couldn't tell, we've already outlined the whole thing.
I can see it. You guys are like, no, we have it. We can't talk about it. We got the idea. Trust me.
isn't there a thing with Stephen King where like he'll lend out his IP for like a ridiculously small price or something? Do I remember that? Am I remembering that correctly?
He lets any short story happen, right?
Is like, that what it is? Like, I know there's something. Yeah, he'll let anybody. Yeah, for a dollar, something like that. Like he'll let anybody use one of his stories. So like, I feel like, I don't know. I feel like, because there actually have been some solid Stephen King adaptations in more recent years. That's one I think is ripe. So I don't want to ruin it for you guys and say like, you know, give away the idea. But I do like that idea. I wish you guys would. I hope that's one you guys actually get.
We hope so too. It seems like it's a tricky one from the conversations we've had. But, you know, we're not going to give up. So hopefully, Stephen, if you listen to this, we're not giving up.
he's a big fan. I think he was our first subscriber. So yeah, likely he'll probably get the first download.
Oh my gosh.
Now, listen, this is a horror movie podcast, so we're obviously all horror movie fans and we all love horror, and that's kind of our thing. But I'm kind of curious, because you guys are filmmakers, are there other genres you would ever want to cross over into, like any other ideas, things you would like to do? Because, again, I know some filmmakers don't want to just be, you know, I mean, listen, you're talking to the biggest horror fans in the world here. I want you guys to keep making horror films. But is there anything else you would dream about doing? Like, is there a comedy in you? Is there a buddy cop comedy in you? Like, is there any other genre you guys have thought about crossing over into?
Contained buddy cop movie where the cops are trapped in a jail cell. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That could
be good
work. We have thought about some more like just kind of straight up like thrillers or drama thrillers, just some dramas. I know a long time ago we had discussed this one kind of offbeat comedy idea, but I don't know if that's ever gonna happen. David shaking his head. No. Yeah, and then some, like, there's this one like quirky kind of fun thriller that we've thought about. So I don't know that we would really venture like all the way to the other side of the spectrum per se, but you know, eventually down the line, I think that we'll branch out a little bit. It's just always at the end of the day, you know, we really respond to stories that have characters that you really love and want to follow, and you know, that has a strong emotional core. So maybe in the future. Also, like, oh, if we had the chance to do like Harry Potter, then yeah, we would do something that's not horror for sure. So there you go.
There you go. Well, it's funny because Boy Behind the Door, like, it is a thriller as much as it is a horror film. Like, I think of like movies like The Hitcher, which I loved, and if you remember the movie Joyride, which I always have an affection for, and I've watched that movie. I saw it in the theater, and I've watched that movie a million times. I did not realize that J.J. Abrams wrote it. Like, I did not remember the Joyride was written by J.J. Abrams. But like, that's, again, it's a horror movie, but it's a thriller. Like, that's that, and I think there's a visceral feel to Boy Behind the Door as well, where it's a horror film, but it's also a thriller. It's a kind of like, you know, white knuckle thriller when you start watching that movie. So there is an element of that in that movie as well.
Yeah.
Thank you. We actually were talking about Joyride today. We're really big fans of that movie, and yeah, it's just great in so many ways.
Yeah, I love. Well, I think I mentioned that to Patrick recently. I was like, I feel like we need to review this one because I kind of forgot how much I loved that movie, and then I watched it recently again. I was like, God, this movie's so good. Like, they do such a good job of like everything done, and it's just, and again, you know, like I said, great actors involved. Steve Zahn is great. It's just a really, really, really good, well done, like tense thriller. Now I know you guys answer some version of this question a million times over, and I'm trying to phrase it in a different way to give you a little bit of a different option here. Cause I know every podcast you do, every interview you do, what's your favorite scary movie? Listen, we all have our favorites. I understand that we're a horror movie podcast, but I'm going to go in a little slightly different angle with this question, which is not necessarily what's your favorite horror movie, because that's such a broad question. Cause if you ask me today, my answer might be different than it would be 2 weeks from now, because I change all my favorites. But I'm curious what the scariest movie, what movie terrified you the most? Not necessarily your favorite, but what movie freaked you out the most? Like, we talk about in our podcast, we did an international horror episode and we talked about the movie Martyrs. I don't know if you guys have seen Martyrs. That is what, I will never watch that movie again. Like, it freaked me out so bad. It was so like terrifying. I'll never watch it again. There are certain movies like that. So I'm curious, not necessarily your favorite horror movie, what movie scared you the most?
I'm gonna let you take this, David.
Okay. I actually have this one. So obviously obsessed with Child's Play and Chucky. Like, it was this weird relationship of just being fascinated, but also like terrified. Like, is he in the closet? Even though we didn't have a doll like that. But that's not what I'm gonna say. It's this movie called, I think it's called Alive, or It's Alive. It was about this like weird mutiny like baby. It's like he comes out and it's like this demonic baby thing, and it just kills everybody. And I was really young when I watched it, but I was at my grandparents' house and it was like dark, and it was very typical to like watch movies when everyone like was sleeping, and I would watch like scary movies. And my God, I put this one in and I was so freaked out. It was like, it was actually kind of a traumatic experience. Every noise, I thought it was this demonic baby just in the shadows. So I need to figure out what that one's called, but it looks also very terrifying, the makeup design of this baby. I don't know. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
I know what you're referencing. Something alive, and it's, correct me if I'm wrong, there's like glowing eyes.
Yeah, the eyes are big, and it has these weird fingers. It's almost like pterodactyl fingers or something.
Yeah, there's something in there. I can't pull it. I feel like I've seen a clip of it on like a horror compilation or something like that.
If you're young, it's really scary. I don't know.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great time to really get scared. It's when you're too young to be watching something.
I feel like mine would be from then too. Like I don't get like scared from horror movies anymore. I just enjoy them. So that's a really tough question for me. But I would have to go way back also. So this is going to sound ridiculous, but I do remember the one that actually scared me the most at the time was Poltergeist. And that was because I had a clown toy that was, I swear, like identical to that one. Like it was the same. And I just remember like after I saw that movie, I was like so traumatized. And to this day, I don't remember what I did to the clown. I just got rid of it. Like I've blocked out in my mind like what I did, and like no one in my family knows what I did to it, but I like made sure it was gone. And like it's just like I'm never gonna even like know, like because the trauma, like I blocked out whatever I did to make sure that that was gone from my life.
Probably buried it in the backyard.
Probably.
So, Justin, let me just say we are kindred spirits, because I think I've talked about this on the podcast before. Poltergeist is kind of that movie for me, because when I was a kid, I lived on a street. We had a street light near my window and we had a tree outside my window. So there was always a constant shadow of this tree on my curtains in my room growing up. And then when it would storm and it would lightning, you would see flashes of this tree. So the tree in Poltergeist for me, when the tree attacks the kid, scared the living hell out of me as a child. And I literally used to put a blanket up over my curtain to hide the tree shadow from coming into my room, because that scene in the Poltergeist traumatized me so bad as a child. So I'm with you. You had the clown, I had the tree, but it freaked the hell out of me. And I could not sleep without having something over my curtain to block out the tree shadow, because I was always convinced it was going to break through and grab me.
That movie, I mean, for kids is not... It's not good for kids.
Yeah. That one fucked me up.
Yeah, the tree would have gotten me too if I had a tree outside like that. I'm really glad that I didn't, because I don't know what I would have done if I got rid of the clown like that. The tree might have been chopped down.
Yeah, it scared the hell out of me, man. Like I said, I'm kindred spirit, because that movie scared me to my depths, and it always freaked me out. Always for years, it freaked me out after I saw it.
Real quick, because of your guys bringing up the supernatural element of Texas Chainsaw earlier, it just got me thinking, is there some horror thing that you guys need to settle? Like, we've got a group of serious horror aficionados here. Do we need to settle something? Is there something you guys bicker about all the time about horror? Like, why is so-and-so do this, this and that? Is there anything like that that's like getting at your craw that we could probably fix here?
I mean, I don't know of like a debate or anything that we have. I do have like a frustration that I know David always feels.
I'm going to talk about, okay, just go.
I don't know if we're going to say the same thing. I was about to mention, I know what you did last summer.
I thought you were going to talk about a different type of filmmaking that's really popular lately,
but I don't even want to go into that.
I does it start with found and end with footage?
Oh, that too, but
no. That too.
It wasn't even gonna be that.
Oh, really? I mean, I'm if you don't want to get into it, that's fine, but I'm very curious, because found footage is polarizing.
I'll let you go then.
Well, I don't want to get into it, and I don't want to talk.
Yeah, we're not here. We are defenders of filmmakers. Okay. Full stop.
Because there's a couple movies recently that, to us, they're horror movies, but they're very long, they're very artistic, and they're also, beautifully shot, amazingly shot, great actors. It's like the Christopher Nolan thing, like all the amazing like aspects of filmmaking, but the story is a little long and confusing. And like these movies are like, so many people love them.
You are dancing around A24, aren't you?
I didn't say that.
You know what? You don't. He did not say that. David did not say A24. No. But who says A24 all the time? Damon says.
So I don't want to cut you off, David. Let me just tell you. I feel like you and I have just connected because I am with you on the same brain. I don't want to disparage an entire filmmaking industry. I'm just going to say, listen, some films are excruciatingly long, arty, very beautiful, but I don't really get it. So I didn't say any movies, Midsommar. I didn't say any names. I'm just saying, I understand where you're coming from.
Don't say that.
I understand where you're coming from.
That's sort of the thing, like, as you know, us, we're trying to be filmmakers and trying to understand like what really resonates with an audience. Mm-hmm. All we know is what we sort of like as horror fans. And I just don't know how such a large audience, I don't know. For me, if you wouldn't want to rewatch a movie, I don't think you really like the movie. And who wants to rewatch 3 hours when the story and everything that happens is just so cruel to like the main characters? Like, it's like cruelty for cruelty's sake. Some of the scenes, we're talking about the same movie, but like,
we don't even know what movie you're talking about.
I don't know what you're talking about.
And then they did a director's cut that was even longer and people went to see that too.
You know what I think it's like? I think it's kind of like the whole comic book movie thing. Like, there is a subset of genre fans and they love movies from a particular alphanumeric production company. And it's just like, I'm going to love whatever they put out. I enjoy great filmmaking, and I'm sure there's lots of aspects of that stuff you guys can appreciate. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. Not that you're saying anything.
I just want to understand, because then
Can I ask for your I Know What You Did Last Summer take, Justin? I'm curious about this because that's one of those, like, I was a fan of 90s horror. Like, maybe I'm one of the outliers because like Scream is like the movie that kind of got me back into horror when I kind of gotten out of horror for a little while. Scream is the movie kind of got me back in. So I have like an affectionate nature for like those 90s horror films like Scream, The Faculty, Disturbing Behavior. Like, I have a certain place in my heart for those kind of movies. But you mentioned I Know What You Did Last Summer, so I'm curious your take on that.
Well, first, I'd like to say David and I both really enjoyed the movie X by A24.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Loved it.
I was going to bring that up. Ty West is like a genius. We're huge fans of his. And X was phenomenal. One of the best movie of the year.
We both loved it. So just, you know, wanted to settle that about A24. with regards to...
They're never going to hire us.
Never.
They're not going to listen to this podcast, so I think we'll be all right.
With regards to I Know What You Did Last Summer, we absolutely love 90s horror also. Actually, like we've discussed this, we think that like Scream collectively as an entire like franchise is probably like the best horror franchise in terms of like consistency. With I Know What You Did Last Summer, really, really, really love that movie, but just get endlessly frustrated with like how they take out Helen. Like, it's just, she's the one that I feel she does everything right. Like every single thing, like in her chase scene, her incredible epic chase scene, like one of the best chase scenes of all time, if not the best, she does everything right, except for she turns around like last minute and she shouldn't have, sure. But like, then you have Jennifer Love Hewitt And she does every single thing wrong and survives. And it's just like the most frustrating thing. It's like, first she doesn't trust her friend. Then she gets onto this boat of a stranger that goes off into nowhere. And she keeps going deeper and deeper into this boat. And it's like, what is she doing with this ice? Like, what are you trying to do? Like, it's just like everything. And then even when she like finally gets out, she's just like totally helpless. And it's like going to get killed if his hand didn't happen to get stuck in like, you know, the mesh net. And it's like, meanwhile, like Helen just like, oh, she turned around. And that's like, but it's just, I don't know. I'm just endlessly frustrated at that because I'm just like, she should have been the final girl. She should have been the one that made it. David feels the same way.
We can relate to her plight.
We're like, go-goer. What, like, we do everything right and make one mistake and it all comes crashing down.
I know it's sacrilege to bring this up because I am, and I think Patrick knows this, I am probably the biggest John Carpenter fan in the world. I'm staring up at in front of my screen right now. I have my Prince of Darkness poster, so I am a massive John Carpenter fan. But it's kind of like Laurie Strode in the original Halloween. Like, she makes every wrong move to like get away. Like, she does, like, she drops the knife. Like, I know that's like one, like, every horror fan's biggest like issue with her. She drops the freaking knife. Like, how are you gonna drop the knife and then turn your back on the killer? Come on. Like, I get it, exactly what you're saying. Like, we gotta have a better final girl. Like, you're right. Like, the one girl who actually does the right things is the one who dies. The one who does everything wrong actually survives.
Yep. She's trying to warn the cop. She kicks her way out of the cop car. She runs to her like useless sister who aids in getting her killed. I mean, she like has to fight this dude off when he like jumps on her. She's like pulling herself up this escalator thing. And then like, you know, she has the moment of like, she's really high up, but she just jumps. And it is like, all right, she does everything right. And still,
yeah,
except for that one thing.
A lot of effort just to get killed.
Yeah.
It's not right.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's another, like, I am a fan of 90s horror and I love those films. I just watched The Faculty recently again. I still love that movie. You guys have given us so much of your time. We appreciate it. I'll close out on this because you guys have been so gracious to talk with us for as long as you have. Of course, you guys are always busy doing things. So can we ask, like, what you got? I don't want you to give away secrets or anything, but like, can we expect more coming soon? Because you can clearly tell we are big, big fans of your work. We love The Boy Behind the Door. We love The Djinn. I cannot wait to see what you guys do next. I think, again, this is before we knew you, had you on the show. You can go back and listen to the episode of Boy Behind the Door. We said at that time, we cannot wait to see what you guys do next. So can you give us a hint? Are you guys working on something currently in terms of what your next project is going to be?
We have a couple of things that are moving forward and hopefully actually become a go. So hopefully you will see us soon. See our work soon. We're really keeping our fingers crossed. We don't want to, we're afraid that we're going to befall Sarah Michelle Gellar's fate with these films, but we're trying our best not to.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's, you know, in filmmaking, nothing is for certain until you're like literally on set rolling. So,
and even then.
Yes, totally. And even then. So it's all this stuff has just been a long journey. So we're trying to remain optimistic.
Yeah. Well,
you guys have a place here at Rewind and the Living Dead. Anytime you want to talk about your journey, it's fascinating. Like, I'm absolutely in awe of the stuff that you guys have done so far. So we're glued to whatever you do next. We're super, super excited about that.
Yeah. I'll tell you ahead of time after this appearance, when you do your next film, you're stuck coming back. I'm just telling you ahead of time, like, I'm not going to stop blowing you up until you come back for your next film, because now that you've been here once, you got to come back. So I'm just warning you ahead of time.
A disclaimer that you guys agreed to when you clicked into the Zoom. Sorry.
Yeah. It's like the agreement you never read at the end. There was actually an agreement that you will come back and see us again for your next film. Justin, David, thank you guys so much for taking the time. We really do appreciate it. It's been a blast chatting with you. Hopefully we didn't keep you too long. We just got into a great conversation. We just kept going. I didn't realize how long we kept going. Thank you guys for taking the time. We really do appreciate it. As I said it before, The Gin and Boy Behind the Door are both available right now. Go watch them. They're both incredible, incredible films. If you've listened to our Boy Behind the Door episode, we love that movie. So go watch them, check them out. And thank you guys so much again for taking the time. We can't wait to see what you do next. And as Patrick said, and I do sincerely mean this, you always have a home on Rewind of the Living Dead. So thank you so much for doing this, guys.
Thank you very much for having us.
Of course. Thank you. We'll definitely be back. Thanks so much.
We appreciate it. We'll talk soon, okay?
All right. Talk soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
See ya.
All right, bye.